John Rivette with Jack Stever on April 2nd, looking at the first draft of the beginning of the school labor relations at MSU. Dr. Stever, what have I made erroneous statements concerning?
They are not erroneous, they're just a few observations, maybe some suggestions.
Great,
and so on.
I appreciate it.
All right, on page 3.
Okay, hold on so I can see. Okay.
Third paragraph down. I would guess where you quote Killingsworth or as saying only a dozen American university had similar centers. I doubt that anywhere near a dozen had similar centers. If you're talking about any that had any course offerings or anything like that, the only ones that that were really in business was the Cornell, which you know a lot more about. And then if Illinois was sort of starting up, Minnesota had a center, but the others would not have been at all significant, or, and certainly not any that would, unless you're talking maybe only about some union programs.
Well, you know what, I think that needs to be, it is confusing, and I think you're right, only those three are centers, but I was really talking about worker ed.
Yeah, well, if you're working, I don't know, maybe Berkeley was, I doubt that they were underway, but that's
well,
not so important.
For workers.
The other one is,
Jack?
Nobody
school
who
for
knows
workers.
Nobody who knows Killingsworth ever call him Chuck.
Uh-huh.
or Charlie. That's in the same paragraph.
Oh, I did, didn't I?
Yeah. It's always been Charles.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Now then, in the last paragraph, Fred was the first person, but Rogers did not come on until probably about 1958. Dalt McFarland, who was a business school, who was in the business school, was the first associate director for management programs.
What year did Rogers come on? You're right.
Probably about 1958, because I became director in 59 when Killingsworth.
Well, that's when you became director.
Yeah, but I know that because Charles at that time told me one of your first jobs will be to get rid of Rogers. So I know that he had hired Rogers a year or so earlier. It could have been early, but you might. Dalton McFarland was the first associate director for the.
D-O-L-T-O-N?
Yeah, D-A-L-T-O-N. Dalt McFarland, yeah.
MCFHARLAND. Okay, and people called him Dalt.
Yeah.
Now, what was the story in terms of that Charles Killingsworth asked you when you became the second director of the school to get rid of?
Well, no, he said that one of the first things I would need to do was probably to try to replace Rogers because he had hired him. And he wasn't working out, so.
Was there a particular?
But that's how I just sort of dated as being a year or so before I took over.
Were there particular things about how Rogers was doing the job that made it that why Killingsworth said that to you?
I don't remember that. I think he probably felt that he was, that the management program was not getting a fair enough shake as compared to the labor program. In other words, I think, but I only know what happened afterwards. I don't remember what the rationale was earlier. But then from there.
But the rest of that's accurate at that point.
After you could just mention the original director was McFarland, and he was succeeded a couple of years later by Charles Rogers.
Did you, McFarland, and Fred Haler all come in at the same month?
McFarland had already been at MSU. It's only Fred and I that arrived at the same time.
So McFarland was at MSU in a different department and gets moved out?
It didn't move over because we didn't have any appointment processes. It was just, he was a professor in the business school. But he also then became associate director for the management program. But that was just a part-time assignment. His main appointment was in the business school because we didn't have any lines to appoint people with any faculty status or anything.
Understood. But what was the second department for Fred Haler?
I think Fred became professor in political science. And I originally was hired in the Department of Economics, jointly also with the
LAR Center. Well, I did send this, just like this, to Fred Haler and to Jackie Brophy, and asked them to comment.
Well, so Jackie wasn't there yet.
No, I understand, but in terms of the thing,
to let you know. And Fred might not have known what was going on in the other in the management program, but that would be my.
So did you all come in sometime in the spring of 56 or
summer? I reported on June 1st of 1956.
June 1st. No, I reported July 1st, so they did it earlier then.
Well, if I had known that there was not much to do at the time, I wouldn't have made it that late. I even didn't go to my commencement exercises at Harvard because I thought if they said June 1st, they must have meant it. So I left.
What were you doing? Were you with the steelworkers then?
No, I was getting my PhD at Harvard.
When was the steelworkers?
1948 to 1950.
And for the steelworkers, you were in research department, or you?
Yeah.
Were you running it? I don't remember.
No. Otis Brubaker was the research director.
I don't know that name.
Otis. No. Well, I had worked with Otis.
Wartime?
In a manpower program under the Wilson Wyatt called the Veterans Emergency Housing Program, which was supposed to build houses for veterans under $10,000 a year.
Okay.
And there was a section called the labor section, which had some very later developed top-notch people. For example, Bob Fleming was in that program. Mm-hmm. And Otis Brubaker, and half a dozen or more other people like that.
Did Fleming already have his PhD at that time, or
he's a lawyer. He had a law degree.
JD. But did he already have his JD at that point?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
All right. Then I think we can skip all the way.
We're okay on the rest of that next little part.
Yeah, I don't have any. There, you're quoting a lot from the hearings, and you had some access to things.
Does this set of, I mean, I am quoting from the hearings, does it sound like what you remember?
Yeah, more or less. You know, these were also speeches that were made that you must have had a tape to, and so on.
Now, what I don't have here is, and you could add to this, what did you or Fred testify to in the hearing?
Well, I'll get to it later.
Okay.
On page 8. Mm-hmm. Where you talk about the testimony, that they heard from me and Fred, also Killingsworth, because he was the one that really had set up the program.
Just the three of you then?
Well, a lot of other people testified. Dalt McFarland testified. President Haney eventually testified just as a side.
Rogers spend a lot of time on that?
Yeah, Rogers testified. And I think actually Hannah, you know, this was a three-member commission. These were days when the Michigan legislature was controlled by conservative Republicans. The commission was made up of two Republicans and one Democrat.
Who was the other?
I don't remember. They were unimportant, but because it was Francis that really had instituted, Senator Francis from Midland.
What else can you tell me about Senator Francis from Midland?
Not really much. He's just very, very conservative, and was sort of considered Dow Chemical Senator because that's where he came from.
Well, reason I ask is I've been told by others that he was considered under the control of Dow Chemicals, how some would phrase it. I was also told that he was actually close to the John Birch Society.
I have no idea about that.
Okay.
So that would be on the first paragraph for page 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
do you want to tell me anything about your testimony, what you said? I mean, I have a bit of
I was really there because I was sort of the associate director for research, and they asked about reprints. The only one I remembered distinctly, and thought, you have a transcript of the hearings, don't you? Well, you ought to check that. That'd be better in my memory. For example, Senator Francis said something like, I understand that one of your publications, not mine personally, the school's publications, was a reprint of something about a man named Powderly, but he's been dead for so many years. Why would you be interested in that? That sort of thing. And then another one, there was a professor. We used to have joint appointments for research. In other words, we would buy time from people like LaRue and the history professor Sullivan. Sullivan wrote an article about the copper mine strike,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of thought that this was too pro-labor and fomenting dissension between labor and management about writing about a strike that had taken place years ago. But it was that sort of thing. But the best thing would be to just look at what the transcript says. Actually, one of the interesting things about it in terms of personalities, and they said they wanted Hannah to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannah said, just let me know when you'll need me and I'll be there. And they said, no, you be there and we'll tell you when we're ready for you. So that Hannah sort of sat there sometimes for half a day or a whole day waiting for them to call on him, even though he was available but didn't want to waste his time, but it was to show who was in control.
Go ahead.
No, the bottom of that about this cocktail thing in the,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't say, you probably were aware of it or no, that meeting between the quote-unquote businessman and teacher took place in Kellogg Center. It didn't specify that. And also there.
Were you at the take when it was taken, or you just know that afterwards from your role?
Oh no. Well, Fred and I knew. You know, I knew that the film was being made, and we talked about it. And
who actually was involved in making the film, Fred and?
Well, I think Fred sort of instituted it,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we even had any money. I think that's why the guy, the businessman, was the director of something in the university called the Audiovisual Center or something like that, because we wouldn't have to pay him. And also the so-called teacher was his wife. So that when he made what you refer to as a suggestive phrase, I would rather talk about you. It wasn't as if he was trying to pick her up or anything like that, but they were just sort of kidding around. But the way in which it was publicized in the newspapers and elsewhere was that, whereas when we interviewed, when Gus Scholl was interviewed, he was sitting in his office with his sleeves rolled up and a real, you know, businessman or labor leader kind of photo, whereas when the film showed the businessman, they showed it in what some people started describing as a cocktail lounge and things like that.
And that was part of the Kellogg Center, the dining room there?
Oh yeah, where no alcohol was allowed. So that what they had in a glass before them was obviously water or something else, but it wasn't alcohol.
Because you had to go across the street to Dagwitz or something?
Well, I don't know. It wasn't anything there.
Did Fred write the script?
I don't have any idea. No, I don't know.
Was Rebus involved?
I don't know. No, I don't. I think Fred more or less working with this, I forget his name, but he is no longer at the university, but in charge of the Audiovisual Center. You can ask them who, you know, somebody getting records who was there in the 1950s.
But that person didn't testify?
No.
Okay.
No, he didn't.
But you got asked, did you get asked much about the film or mostly about the reprints?
No, I think that Fred would have testified about the film because he would have been the one that was responsible for it. And I had never seen it really before it was done. And then Rogers picked it up and started showing it to management people.
Mm-hmm.
As what the kind of thing that...
When did he start doing that?
Well, that would have been shortly before the hearings.
No,
it led to the hearings, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't a very long period of time.
So when do you think the film came out?
Well, probably about, I think the hearings were, what do you have it here, is 61 or something like that? Or 50?
No, there were. Hannah appeared September 61.
61? Well, then the hearings were in 61. You know,
yeah,
it takes a couple of years.
September 61. But, you know, I'm not sure that I wrote down when the film was released. That's why I'm asking. Because Francis's first speech is June 61.
Okay, so the hearings probably were in the summertime.
Okay.
And then on page 9.
Mm-hmm.
See, the reason because we we didn't have any appointments in the school that had faculty status. Everybody then who had faculty status had to have a department.
Mm-hmm.
So when Rogers was hired, he was hired as an associate professor in the business school.
Okay.
Even though they absolutely didn't want him, or said we don't need him, but we said, well, we need this fellow in the school, and the only way in which we could get him an appointment which he would accept would be to have some kind of status.
What was he doing before he was
hired? He's a lawyer. He was an attorney, and he had a lot of connections in Michigan and so on. I think one of the things that that was difficult with Rogers, he didn't believe that anybody could teach labor management relations except people who came out of the field.
Mm-hmm.
So that all the people, whenever he put on a program, it was always from people from management, and he didn't want to use university people or academic people from other universities.
Uh-huh.
I remember once I had forget his name, he's a retired professor at Berkeley, but he wrote one of the first books on local labor unions, and I remember got it.
Strauss?
Yeah, George Strauss, that's right. And I sort of insisted that Rogers put him on the program that he was running, and he then did, but he said, you see, business people aren't interested in local unions and things like that. They want to know the nitty-gritty of labor management relations.
So you forced him to?
Well, you know, he agreed to do it, but it was that kind of thing that it was difficult to, since we had a number of joint appointments with other departments, those people, some of them were joint appointments to do research, but others were joint appointments to do teaching to labor and management people.
Right.
But he was reluctant to use those kind of people because he didn't feel that they had any experience and so
mm-hmm.
on. So that when it says he freely resigned rather than being fired, it was just once I decided that he would have to be removed it was not as if he was going to lose his job. In other words, then we say, you go back, and you not go back, go and take up your appointment in the business school. Now, of course, the dean of the business school didn't like that at all because, you know, he said, when we agreed to hire him, it was only because you needed him. Now you want us to start paying him and have him, we can't use him. He doesn't have an academic background or anything. And I don't know for 100%, but I think it's, my recollection is that the dean, Dean Seeley at that time, said, okay, if we got to use him, here's your teaching schedule, one course at 8 o'clock in the morning and another course at 6 o'clock at night. And I don't think Rogers ever took up the appointment. I don't blame him.
So that, but he wasn't. It's true that he didn't get fired, but it's also not true.
Well, he was, that's right, just like McFarland, although McFarland did it on his own, he wasn't removed. He just decided he didn't really want to spend a good part of his time in that program when he also was teaching in the business school.
Let me just make sure he wasn't fired, but he didn't freely resign. He resigned because he was given choices he found unacceptable.
I would say the wording would be removed.
Well, he was removed from the center.
From the associate director of the management program and was therefore free to take up his appointment in the business school, but he never did, as far as I know.
He was offered, but what he thought unacceptable.
Yeah, yeah.
Terms in business. Before you switch the page, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
LaRue's appointment was a research and econ.
Yeah, I think he probably had a half-time appointment to do research. In fact, he wrote a couple of articles that we used to issue reprints in those days for articles that had been published in a journal. And if you had an article published, then the research director would decide whether or not it was something that they wanted to put in a reprint series.
Let me go through a couple more that I wanted to ask you. Adams is also...
No, he had nothing to do with the school.
I thought he did.
No, he was opposed to it.
Excuse?
He was opposed. He didn't think that there was any need for labor or a school, labor and industrial relations center. And after all, and Killingsworth was the chairman or the department, or at those days I think they called it head, and I think
right,
you referred to it.
Yeah.
But no, Adams had nothing to do with the school.
Sullivan was?
Well, Sullivan was another, was a history professor.
And it was a research?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fonts?
Bill, we hired Bill in 1957 as a part-time person, and his appointment was in sociology. He subsequently became chairman of sociology and associate director in school. Bill Form was when I became director, then Bill Form, who was professor of sociology, became associate director for research in 59.
And Fonts worked for him?
No, Fonts.
Then moved
it
on.
Was after Bill didn't want to be research director any longer. Then Fonts, who had a joint appointment for research in those days, became director of
Form.
Pardon me? Yeah.
Form. Now, Ripas, did he have another appointment?
I believe he had an appointment in political science. I'm not sure. But I don't think he could have had any other appointment.
Well, he didn't have a PhD.
Well, that was neither did Fred. But in other words, these were really sort of worked out with the department, with the departments on a complementary basis. Okay,
right.
In other words, they say, well, we don't need, we don't need these people. I think the only exception was myself, because I was really hired, since my degree was in economics. I taught in the economics department some evening courses mostly, because I was occupied otherwise in the daytime. In the school.
Well, you're more like Killingsworth then, in some ways. I mean, you're
Killingsworth,
right? Even though you.
Yeah, Killingsworth He continued as head of both economics and the school for a couple of years, mm-hmm. but he left and he because, and I don't really know that it's relevant, he was offered a university professorship mm-hmm. at the University of Wisconsin, which is where he came from. Mm-hmm. And my, as he told me, I guess, when he told Professor Hanna that he would, that this was not, was the kind mm-hmm. of thing he absolutely couldn't turn down, Hanna said, why? And he said, because that's a university. He says, that's nothing, I'll make you a university professor here. Mm-hmm. And he did. And at that time, Charles was the only university professor in the university, which meant that, you know, like other university professorships, you could really teach in any department that you wanted, or mm-hmm. teach as much as you wanted, right. or do research, or right. whatever else
and
you
And Charles want. Decided to teach in...
So, yeah, but so that once he was offered that, he decided, well, then he'll stay at MSU.
I had a couple more I wanted to ask you. Kruger and Einar Hardin?
Well, Einar was hired the same year I was. I had nothing to do with it. I knew him because we were graduate students together in Minnesota. But when, you know, there was a school had enough money. It was, these were very plush years in those times. And a lot of people came with joint appointments. A man named Kurt Aller, A-L-L-E-R, who was a research appointment and also an economics faculty member, and LaRue was in economics, and I was in economics.
So Hardin was econ?
Hardin was a joint appointment.
What about Kruger?
Kruger, I'm not sure. If he was, he probably would have been in economics also.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was
yeah.
either.
But he would have, he couldn't have, he came in 57, so he wouldn't have been able to have only a faculty in the school.
Right, so he had to be.
Yeah.
Are we missing other names from that?
Well, there are others, but I can't remember.
Well, one would be Al Blum?
Oh, Blum didn't come until well into the 60s.
Okay.
Maybe 61, 62.
Oh, okay.
Now on page 10.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the you're right here that at the top of that, when the College of Social Science was established, then the people who had joint appointments, except for me, because my original appointment was really primarily, at least as much in economics, were told that either they had to choose to stay in the department or get their appointment in the school.
And so Faunce chose to go somewhere?
He was always in sociology.
Okay.
That was, the other was really temporary, but the others who most of their time was spent in the school, or 100% of their time, mm-hmm. for example, Kruger would be 100% in the school, and Fred was 100% in the school, mm-hmm. and Bob was 100%. But they had these other complementary appointments,
and they lost.
And they were they were difficult because every time we came to a salary increase or something, I had to negotiate,
mm-hmm.
because the money was partially coming from a department,
mm-hmm.
and so once they were given an opportunity to have a full-time appointment with a faculty appointment in the school,
mm-hmm.
they said sure that they preferred that. So that's what happened.
So, who chose to leave the school at that point?
Everybody who had a joint appointment, not leave the school. No, nobody chose to leave the school. Everybody who had a joint appointment
left their joint department.
Left their other department and got their appointment, faculty appointment in the school. In other words,
okay.
Haler, Hardin, Reepas, Kruger. Anybody who had that kind of a joint appointment became the same level of appointment in
okay.
the school.
But people like Faunce and LaRue?
Not Faunce. Those are different because they didn't have any appointment in the school.
Okay.
Really, we were just buying their time.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, instead of teaching a full load in economics or in other places, you would only be teaching a half-time load, and the other half of your time you would be able to devote to research.
Is that what Sullivan would have been?
Yeah.
Okay, now you said you were different. What did you mean?
Because my original, I was really hired in the economics department, I guess because there was no, they didn't have to really be forced to take me. In other words, they were perfectly satisfied because my degree was in economics, and they were perfectly...
What was your dissertation topic?
Well, it was a steel industry wage structure.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so that would be on page 10. And then the only other thing was...
No other problems in that stuff in terms of the...
No.
I don't know how much of this, quite frankly, after is going to stay in there, but just for my benefit, your recollection is the kind of quick summary I've done of some of the programs of the 70s and 80s is fairly accurate?
Yeah, I don't have any things that I
obviously have tilted
different.
More. This is a worker ed kind of audience and
sure.
perspective, but were there, and so I've kind of highlighted what I think were some of the special aspects of the labor ed, not of the academics or of the management.
That's right.
But if I were to say anything about the sort of special focus of the academics or the management, how would you describe that for me?
Well, the focus in the research
uh-huh.
was on automation.
Okay.
A large part of the program for the school was sold on the basis that the main thing that was happening in the United States was automation. And everybody was talking, will that mean that everybody's going to lose their jobs because everything's going to be done by robots? And we used to take trips to automated plants and look at what they were doing and that sort of thing. And the people who were doing several of our reprints, quite a few of them, were on the subject of automation.
Well, in fact, I have some of Einar Hardin's that are just bibliographies on automation.
Might be, yeah.
Yeah. So what would any other special focus of the school?
No, otherwise people did, if let's say Sullivan said, I would like to join appointment because I want to write this article on the copper strike in the Upper Peninsula during its and so on, and we said, yeah, that sounds like a good subject. Or LaRue would say, well, I'm interested in Harry Bridges and I've written about him or I'm writing a book. And he then wrote an article and was published, and we then put out a reprint. A lot of schools did that, but it started costing too much money to put out reprints, and they were given away free and so on. And many years ago, I can't even remember when, but we stopped putting out reprints.
Okay, another question though in terms of, I know you want to tell me something else, but would you say a fair statement is that the school, I have two questions. In terms of the academic focus, that in some ways it did have a special, that it was very much about collective bargaining and unionized labor relations, or would you not say that?
That what was the research?
Well, research and or the school's academic training and its graduate program that starts developing in the 60s and 70s.
Well, but the graduate program really didn't develop, and I think you have it right here, in 1965,
mm-hmm.
After we had the hullabaloo with the Senate hearings and so on, and it was then that President Hanna decided it'd be a good idea with a new college having been established, that we should be in the new college and have our own academic program. And then a committee of the faculty members in the school, the research part of the program in the school, met on a number of occasions and decided they didn't want to have an undergraduate program, but that it should be a graduate program. And that's the way started and continued. We never had an undergraduate program. We didn't want one.
Why?
Well, because I think many of us considered that it was not an undergraduate kind of discipline. In other words, in order to really do research in the field of labor management relations, you should have a good background in either sociology, political science, economics, psychology, whatever,
mm-hmm.
but not just sort of come in right at the beginning and start doing research on collective bargaining. And I think that's still the focus of most programs. Cornell is the big exception, but has always had an undergraduate program.
So that was something special about this MSU school, that it did only have that graduate
program. I think a lot of the programs are only, those that have degree programs would be graduate, but some also are undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I think the reason is that that gave them an opportunity to have a larger faculty.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Cornell, I remember when I chaired a evaluation committee for Cornell, and our committee recommended that they give up the undergraduate program, even though we knew they would never do it. But from an academic point of view, the committee felt that it wasn't a good idea. But there were so many. Cornell had such a large faculty, and most of them were teaching undergraduate
mm-hmm.
courses.
Got another question. Our business management extension operation, personnel management program service, did it have any specialties, or was it always a fairly small program?
Well, it wasn't necessarily small. It was a program was. We both had labor advisory, not labor, we both had advisory committees,
mm-hmm.
a labor advisory committee, a management advisory committee, and they never met. They never met together. We tried once to have a joint meeting, and it got so difficult. In those days, labor management relations were much more adversarial than they have been for the last 20, 30 years. Certainly today, you couldn't have a program like PEERS, for example,
mm-hmm.
Because they just wouldn't see eye to eye on the kind of things that they wanted to discuss.
Uh-huh.
So they were entirely separate kind of programs. But the labor program was, I guess what it really came down to, you see, the labor program always lost money.
Uh-huh.
And the management program always made money.
Mm-hmm.
And Rogers objected. In other words, you know, we make the money, and then the labor people give it away free because the charges for a labor program, I don't remember what they were so minimal, or maybe nothing, I don't know, I don't remember, that while when we run a program, we would be charging $100, $200 a day for people to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the money was being kept in an account, which was together, so that the management program was making money, the labor program was losing money, and being subsidized by the management program,
mm-hmm.
and naturally, or maybe somebody who didn't feel that this was appropriate,
mm-hmm.
When they were in charge of the management program, objected, and
mm-hmm.
they had to accept the idea that it was a joint program.
So Rogers didn't buy into much of the philosophy that President Hanna expressed in his
That's right. Yeah, and then of course, as Hanna said, that management is getting a lot more than labor because they're getting it through the business school, so that the only thing that was needed in the School of Labor or the Labor Industry Center were programs which were narrowly focused on collective bargaining. In fact, they were not even allowed to teach things like personnel or human relations and things like that, which were considered as business school type of programs. So when you take it all together, he would sort of compile statistics and say, when you put it all together, we have several times as much money going into teaching management as we have going into teaching unions. But if you only stick with the industrial relations program or the labor center, well, yes, we have more labor programs, but nobody else does labor programs. You don't do labor programs in economics or sociology or so on.
When did the school's PMPS change and start doing these general HR topics?
Was probably well into the 60s and 70s and so on.
Okay.
In fact, there wasn't much interest in HR. People came to the school because they were interested mostly in unions, and they always wanted to know how to get a job working for unions. Nowadays, that isn't true. We used to tell them it's very hard to get a job working for a union because generally union staff people come out from working in a factory or otherwise, and if you want to really do that, you may eventually be able to be a staff member of a union, but that's not easy. Whereas in management, after human relations became more acceptable as a management focus, people in the school would be interested in that. In fact, I think at the beginning we maybe only had one or two women out of the first 13 or 15 people that enrolled. I can only remember one or two women in the program, and one African American woman. We used to call them black people then, but there wasn't a feeling in management that women really could do a job on the shop floor. So that whereas if they might hire somebody from the school to sort of work in a grievance department or something like that in a factory, they didn't consider that this was a job that women could do. Later on, they found out that they not only could, that they sometimes could do it this better,
just as well or better. It's interesting that you apparently dug up this article that you said Killingsworth wrote, that he originally opposed the center and the school.
You don't recall that?
I don't recall it, but I'm sure you're right. You say you have a footnote on it, so you obviously are right. I can't recall.
I'll check that out, but
the only thing I can read that really took place with when you describe on page 12 what you call an academic freedom dispute in the 1980s.
I put it in quotes because used that phrase.
Well, first of all, of course, you didn't mean that Michigan State was administrative censoring. I think you meant the word there was censuring.
Yes.
In other words, that he was saying that he was censured.
Thank you.
I don't know what who censured him.
Uh-huh.
In other words, my recollection of what happens, and part of it is correct, Bob was teaching a lot of different courses, and a lot of them were the UAW courses, and he was teaching a UAW group, and it was during a primary for governorship, and Zoltan, I don't remember if Zoltan, if it was still the primary fight that Bob said that I wasn't there. There was a discussion of who are you supporting?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, Zoltan is a good friend of mine, so I'm supporting him. And the UAW had already come out in support of somebody, I don't even remember who it was, whether it was Blanchard, it was
Mm-mm.
in the 80s.
The
UAW's position was different.
Fitzgerald?
I don't think so. No, he never. It must have been a primary, I think, because then somebody else won the primary and Zoltan didn't. But the other thing was that they then saw him driving a Subaru, and the UAW. In those days,
felt very strongly that nobody should be buying foreign cars. And therefore, the regional director, and I can't remember who it was in the one of the Michigan regions, said, we don't want REPAS to teach any more of our programs. And that we're not going to have people signing up for them. So that I guess Dale might have then started assigning him to teach other union programs, not the UAW. I think Bob insisted that really, if they don't want to come to his programs, they don't have to, but I guess from a labor point of view, from the point of view of the labor program, we can't afford to have Bob teaching or being assigned to teach a program and then they don't have enough people enrolled or nobody enrolls because the regional director says we won't pay for it. Now, I remember calling Doug Fraser, who was president of the union, and chasing him down and wherever he was traveling and explaining to him that this didn't make any sense and so on and so forth. And he said he agreed, but he said, you know how those things are. Regional directors are elected and I can't tell them what to do. But I don't know, that really was all the involvement that the school had in it. When he calls blacklisting, he may have been blacklisted by the UAW. And now what he calls an administrative, even if you call it censuring, from whom? In other say, allegedly by Stieber and Brickner. But I don't think you could find a piece of paper that would indicate that anybody ever censured him or told him that there was anything that that could be done about it other than to try to persuade the UAW to change their mind.
Okay. To tell you the truth, Jack, I will have to check footnotes and some documents. And I don't know if all of those words are from Bob or from an article about the incident that was in Labor Notes or another kind of labor-oriented journal. So I'm not even positive those are Bob's words.
Yeah, well, but
they may not be.
But and, wasn't there? I think he probably did file a grievance because I remember being in a grievance meeting with the former that grievance officer, Brady.
Mary Brady.
Yeah, you know, talking about it, but nothing ever